Now it's like you get the viral moment, you finish the song
Yeah, yes.
that it was for,
Yeah.
and then you learn how to perform a lot of the time.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Cloud Machine Podcast. My name is Matt Landry, and in the 63rd episode, I'm here with Horace Bray. Throughout the podcast, we discuss session guitar playing, touring, recording and composing, social media, jazz music, teaching, his origin story, music business, and so much more. We also play the producer's game. Thanks for listening. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Cloud Machine Podcast, a platform that allows us to learn more about the music industry through conversations with artists, people in the behind the scenes, music business individuals, creatives, and much more. This podcast is brought to you by Eights, a musical direction and playback company out of Toronto. Our goal with this podcast is to create a network and shine a light on all of this stuff that is happening in the music world, topics and realities that are gatekept, and the people and roles that may often be overlooked. This week, I have the immense pleasure of welcoming Horace Bray to the podcast. He is a guitarist, composer, and producer based out of Los Angeles, California. In addition, he has produced his own work under multiple names, most recently Small Songs, a batch of compositions for solo acoustic guitar. I got the opportunity to meet Horace when he came through Toronto playing guitar with Blue Tiger, and we connected because we have a bunch of mutuals as well in the city, most notably the one and only and lovely Marina Lopez. So please welcome Horace Bray to the podcast. Hi, Horace, how are you?
Hey, man, I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for accepting the invitation. Let's start the podcast. So we always start the podcast by asking you your favorite live show experience as a fan.
Oh, as a fan.
Yes.
That's tricky. Because, like, the first big concert I ever went to was Tom Petty.
Yes, sure.
Which was a great first concert. I thank my mom all the time for that. Yeah. That was great. That was so notable because I was like, I had never experienced music at that scale before. Mm. But my second concert I went to was Coldplay right after, like, Parachutes came out. Oh, and that was the first time I, like, really like saw production, like a show, like during the song Yellow, they had giant yellow balloons drop that had the lyrics written in them. And it's like, you know, now, like, you know, we've seen so many shows and like, we're like, oh yeah, that's like maybe a little cheesy, but like, but to experience that for the first time, my mind was blown. It was so sick.
Yeah.
So those two are definitely up there.
Mm-hmm.
In more of a modern sense of that question, seeing Tame Impala live was really amazing. I knew it was going to be like really trippy and like through composed as an experience, but yeah. I wasn't really prepared for like how, like to what extent that they took that.
Yeah. Was it like a recent thing?
It was like my second festival I ever played with Blue. So it was about 2 years ago.
Yes. Yeah. Where they have like the intro and it's like a pill thing. Is that what it was?
Yeah, like kind of creepy intro with like the voice and
I got a chance to see that show as well, and it was insane. Every show I've seen from Tame has been really nuts.
They're very good at what they do.
Yes, yeah. Is there a project, campaign / era that would best describe your work or represent your work for those who don't know Horace Bray?
Oh man, that's kind of a tricky question because I feel like the last 10 years of my career are very much defined by like starting in a certain place and kind of going around this big circle and ending up almost in the same place.
Okay.
Like, I feel like when I first started pursuing music professionally, I was like very focused on modern jazz and composition and arrangement and like writing my own music and really like appreciating and letting guitar be the main character
in
the music I've been making. And then it's like I got really burnt out on like jazz, and then did like a bunch of singer-songwriter stuff, started to dive into pop stuff. You know, over the pandemic, I was doing a lot of like this lo-fi hip-hop, like lo-fi jazz production. and then was on a pop gig, on a couple pop gigs for like 2-3 years. And now, you know, this year is like a notably a bit more free of things of the pop nature.
Yeah.
So I'm taking a lot of time to finish these projects that I've been talking about finishing for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And now, once again, it's very much about like creating music that represents my relationship with the guitar and like having the guitar function as like a mirror to see myself for like to express through composition.
Yes. Even just seeing it through Instagram, it seems like there's a lot more of the gigging, like the jazz gigging going on.
Yeah.
And you see, you know, as touring musicians and stuff, sometimes you do have those gaps because the artists that you have been playing with, they're maybe in writing mode or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
How have you balanced this year of mainly doing the gigging stuff around the city?
I mean, it's been much easier to balance that than it is to balance like you have to fly to Romania and then be back in 4 days like that. I feel like it's innately not balanced. I've had a great time being in town. I hate to sound like an old guy or like a homebody, but you know, just like I'm someone that finds a lot of like comfort in routine. And like, I love having like, okay, like I'm going to the gym and like, I have like this list of meals that I like to make that I know are healthy, and like, you know, I can go for walks and I can like actually sit down and practice Bach and like all this stuff that I never really, I say I'm going to try to do on tour, but I never really can.
Yeah.
And it's also affording me the luxury of letting myself become bored and like become interested in photography again and all this other stuff that feels very adjacent to the normal creative process that I'm a part of, but also very much enriches it. So I'm very thankful that I've had like a good couple months where I've been able to kind of like sit and like relax into just the way time moves in LA.
Yeah. And it also gives you the chance to, you know, yes, stay grounded, but also develop more, you know, connections to the city that you're in as well. And the people as well, you know. And it's funny to say it like this or think about it like this, but you almost become a more balanced and complete person when staying in your home, in your house kind of thing. It's why, and I'm just thinking about it off like on the fly here, but I love what you're saying. Let's go to the quote section of the pod. We do a quote. Last year it was Eric Badu, an Erykah Badu quote that was sort of comparing the music business and music as an art form. This year, it's a Joni Mitchell quote taken from an interview with Robert Hilburn of the LA Times in 2004. She says, "I heard someone from the music business saying they are no longer looking for talent. They want people with a certain look and a willingness to cooperate." What are your first instincts when you hear that quote?
I mean, I can see why you chose it, because it has there's a lot of relevance, you know.
Yeah, sure.
Because I think that there are two like kind of secondary questions, or like one secondary question that pops up for me, which is like, what is a good artist, and what is a marketable artist?
Yes, sure.
You know, I think the thing that Joni said is very, very true, in that slowly these labels that we've all loved to hate and hate to love, you know, have slowly become much more like hedge funds than they were about like something that where they're talking about long-term developing like of artists and all this stuff. It's like, In the same way that people aren't like funding, like it's the same thing, the same shape of it has been happening all across all industries. You know, it's easy to get dark on the music industry and be like, oh, well, now they're just trying to hoard assets. And it's like, okay, yeah, you look at like Guitar Center got bought out. Like, oh, the, you know, BlackRock owns the music store down the street now. It's like, it's kind of happening everywhere. And the way that they what they the value system that they use to determine what they want to make money with, or like what makes them the most money, has changed. So
yeah,
on one hand, the people that like are down to play the game and are down to make the 7 TikToks a week and are down to like do the cringy stuff that'll go viral, you know, that's what's making them money. And then those are the people that'll get more money. But I don't necessarily think that that an easily marketable artist and a good artist cross over that frequently.
Yes. Yeah. And it's hard these days to sort of place value on artists, I think, anyway. Do you have some distinctions between a marketable and a, let's say, a good artist these days? Do you know how to differentiate?
Oh, I mean, I think a good artist is anyone that's like doing it, just trying to be honest with themselves and like that are down to make statements and. You know, I don't think the highly marketable artist that blew up on TikTok is any less valuable than Clowncore or something like, you know, they just played at Coachella, which I'm shocked. are you familiar with that band?
I'm not, but just the name.
It's like, it's not Lewis Cole on drums. It's a mystery.
Oh, okay.
But it's, but it's like two dudes in clown masks playing like duo noise metal.
Wow. Okay.
And they played Coachella this year. So it's like at a certain point, you're like, okay, well, like, you know, it is nice that like a highly marketable artist, you know, a lot of times that is like what I think about that idiom as the value system that the labels and stuff have.
Yeah.
Like whatever they're valuing in that moment. But ultimately, that is only ever a reflection of what the market or like what the masses really enjoy, because now there's such a low barrier of entry to be able to reach so many people that you can have someone that you really wouldn't expect completely blow up.
Yeah.
So I think it's like as like the labels and stuff want to feed the beast of like the internet and going viral and stuff more and more, it actually kind of takes more and more power away from them in an interesting kind of turn of events.
Yeah.
But good artists are people that really care about what I feel
and
like.
You can be a good artist and also marketable.
Totally.
But do you believe that being marketable is what eventually leads to what's deemed as successful in this industry now in 2024?
I mean, if we're defining success as selling a lot of tickets and making a lot of people a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it definitely helps, but not everyone wants that.
Yes.
Like, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you look at artists like Lizzie McAlpine. She's incredible. I remember when I first saw her Instagram videos like so long ago, like when she like didn't have that many followers. She was still this good.
Yeah, sure.
She's definitely gotten better, but it's like, you knew it then. Like, it was so obvious. And I think it, you know, I think her art is in relating to people. Like, there's certain artists where their art, the art of what they're doing is in the relatability. And then there's certain artists which the art of what they're doing is that it's not relatable, or that it's maybe like this crazy thing that's so odd feeling that like people don't understand it, but they kind of crave the understanding.
Yes.
So I think the artists whose art is expressed through relatability tend to be a lot more successful in a grander scheme of like marketing.
Yeah. And also you see like relatability and authenticity being like one thing in this
oh, day. Yeah.
But then you see like, you know, I don't think it's necessarily a thing of the past, but there's also a thing like you just said that there's like they're the artists that are seemed they seem like gods or something. Like they're just like on an other tier, and there's still those artists that exist. But I feel like a lot of the new artists nowadays to sort of grow in their careers, they need to be relatable, and they need to be authentic to get the masses, because now TikTok is so deemed on relatability and authenticity and trying to feel that way. But let's say artists that were popular 20 years ago, it was all about, oh, they can't be reached kind of thing.
Yeah. Like, when was the last time you saw a Sufjan Stevens interview, you know?
Sure.
Like, probably 20 years ago.
Yeah. Or a Beyonce interview, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
100%.
Which is like a, I think the way we collectively define an idol has maybe shifted.
Yeah.
A little bit. It's less of like that Prince type thing where they're like a figure. They're like,
yeah,
it's this entity that like we don't really know that much about. And like, oh, to the point where it's like where you have like someone like Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
Where people know what she ate yesterday. Like, sure. It's the whole opposite of the spectrum.
Yeah. And with Taylor, I feel like it's almost the two things. You know a lot about her, but she's still so.
Yeah, like, you only know what she wants you to know.
Yeah, exactly. Where do you think the industry is going?
Ooh. I mean, it's tricky because, yeah. I mean, the things I see happening now are Spotify's changing a lot. The algorithms are changing a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, especially like in the lo-fi world, you see a lot more things that like are starting to be more and more AI generated.
Yes.
It's such a buzzword, but like that's the stuff, like the easy listening background music is probably going to be the first stuff to go.
Yeah, know? Sure. That.
I hear about more and more like writing sessions, like instead of it being, you know, like five writers and five producers all going into a cabin and like writing 50 songs. It's a bunch of AI generated songs that a bunch of writers write to, and then they have one producer finishing it. I have been hearing a lot more about that type of thing happening. So I think like there's like in reaction to that starting to happen, I feel like, and I hope there will be a reaction of people starting to really value music that not everyone can play.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like you think about what it means to be a touring musician today, yeah. And what it means to be a touring musician in the 80s, or like to stay in James Brown's band, you had to be so on top of it.
Yeah.
So on top of it. There were probably five people that could hold down that guitar chair, for example.
Yeah.
You know, and now it's not, there's definitely like, it's less about the musicianship on stage, you know, there's, it's a lot easier to do those gigs. Like I could teach someone guitar lessons for 6 months and they could probably take a gig from me, you know?
Sure.
And if they looked cooler on stage doing it, you know?
Yeah.
But I'm hoping, and I feel like there will end up becoming like a greater value on more difficult music to perform, not like music that's difficult to be difficult.
Yeah, sure.
Like shred jazz isn't gonna necessarily become the main thing, but I feel like it'll come back to this, like it's a band and it's like they're playing parts and like, oh,
right.
People taking pride in that, like their show doesn't have any tracks, for example, or like
yeah. And it's a group of musicians interacting kind of thing.
Yeah, I feel like you see those like videos of like Pat Metheny in his prime, like the biggest part where he was like the biggest household name version of himself.
Yeah.
And it was like crazy. It was just like 15 musicians all making this crazy music for like a stadium of people. It's insane. Yeah. And I would love for it to come back to that. I don't know if it will.
Sure.
But that's where I'm hoping it goes.
Because touring is also becoming way more expensive as well. So there's also like those logistics and those expenses as well. But
Yeah. I mean,
but
I'm sure you've been seeing a lot of that.
Oh yeah.
See, we all hear about like, you know, it's hard. It's hard if you don't, it's hard for an artist, because if your songs don't like hit, like a bunch in a row, the funding dries up really fast.
Yes. And I feel like to fund one project is to be like, okay, we won't make any money. We won't make any money this time, but hoping that the next time we tour this place, we can do a bigger show and then bigger show and then bigger.
Exactly.
And it's all dependent on, you know, the rise of the capacity of your venues to make.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think they're realizing that they can invest a lot less money in many more artists because they don't have to spend as much on marketing. Like they don't need to give people $1 million advances now because they can just tell the artists to make a bunch of TikToks.
Yes.
And then they're taking that risk off of them and putting it on the artist. And in doing so, they also usually offer them less money as an advance. So it's like if someone gets a couple $100,000 to do their first two albums and all the tours and all their own promo and their music videos, people don't realize how fast that dries up. And then they're kind of a slave to the internet.
Yeah.
Some people thrive in that, but others don't.
How do you feel about, and we've had this discussion on the podcast over the past month or two about just labels not necessarily having like a marketing strategy anymore. Their marketing strategy is now just artists doing their own TikToks.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that? Is that because I guess that my first instinct there is like these artists shouldn't necessarily dedicate all their time to doing TikToks because the labels, they don't want to, or they can't, or because the platform has deemed authenticity being number one, and being authentic means that the artist has to do the content themselves.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's not an easy job to be a label marketer right now either. Yeah. Like that job also probably sucks. They're probably having the same type of conversation that we're having and that the artists are having and all that.
Sure.
Because it changes so fast, and all it takes is like one line of code to change in TikTok for all of a sudden the thing that was working no longer is working. Same thing with Spotify. It's like, you know, they change the loudness threshold of something and all of a sudden like a bunch of songs are like deemed not playlistable because they got too loud or something or anything like that. You know,
crazy.
It's like, oh, well now the algorithm says that you used seven profanities in the song instead of the allotted six. And now you can't be on an editorial. Like, you know, it's hard. They're chasing a thing that is moving every day.
Yeah.
And the only consistent factor in chasing what is doing well is that people want to see the artist and they want to see the artist being them.
Yeah.
So it sucks. I hate that that's like kind of the name of the game right now, but it's also like with the way the playing field is right now, there's really no other consistent aspect to it.
Yeah.
So I hope it changes. I don't really know how it would, but I'm sure it will.
Yeah, everything changes.
Yeah. You know?
All things must pass, as George Harrison said.
Exactly.
Let's get to the origin story.
Oh, yeah.
Can you give me the lowdown on where you grew up and your creative upbringing, as in family, friends, high school?
Yeah, so this is a little less dark.
Yeah, sure.
Funny transition. TikTok slaves. So I moved around a lot growing up. I was born in Anaheim and then lived in like Maryland and Ohio for a little bit, but then did middle school and high school in St. Louis, Missouri. Specifically a town right outside of St. Louis called Webster Groves. Very cute town. Around eighth grade, I started playing guitar. This guy like lived down the street. I like hit up to actually named Corey Christiansen, who I didn't realize was a very, very good jazz guitar player. I just knew he was like the dude that played guitar. So my mom hit him up first, and then he told her like he doesn't take kids, the students, which now I very much understand. But then I ended up like hitting him up in the phone book basically and asked him myself, and my mom hadn't told me that he said no yet. And then he told me yes, but under the stipulation that if I didn't do every assignment that he gave me for 2 weeks in a row, I'd be cut.
Wow.
So.
Wow. Okay.
It was very hardball and it was great. So I studied with him for like a year and a half and that really put me in a good direction.
Yeah.
My high school had a really good jazz program. It's like they kind of threw all their funding into that instead of the marching band, which was very odd and unusual, but great for the people that were into jazz music.
Yeah.
Then, you know, there was Jazz at the Bistro, the main jazz club in St. Louis, had a really great after school program that I was a part of as well.
Okay.
Met a lot of people through that. And then went to University of North Texas.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Which is, for those who don't know, is an iconic school for all things music, really.
Yeah, it was the first jazz program in the United States.
which is absolutely nuts. How was your experience at the university?
It was good. It's definitely like a lot of big band music, which I'm so glad I got to experience then because you really don't get to otherwise. And it's a lot of traditional stuff, but as a reaction to that, a lot of the students create very, very interesting music outside of the school, like a lot of like proggy metal, jazz, like Tigran Hamasyan type stuff. And like Snarky Puppy is from that area. A lot of those dudes were around when I was there. So there was a lot of like this, like that type of funk fusion happening, which was great. Right. RC and the Grits and Erykah Badu are around there. Just a bunch of crazy musicians all the time.
Yeah.
You know, crazy gospel scene in Dallas.
Oh, insane. Man. Yeah. So you're saying that a lot of that music was created because school was so big band oriented and it was almost like an anti, almost big band vibe?
For the music that the students were making, definitely.
Right.
I definitely, like, you know, RC and the Grits are doing their own thing, regardless of what was happening at UNT.
Sure. But,
yeah, like, you know, I was in this band called Sky Window. It was really cool. Matt Young on drums. It's my favorite drummer ever. It was like kind of a revolving thing. It was me, Matt Young, Jordan Gein on trumpet and like keys. Brad Kang, who's like a really great New York guitar player right now. He was on guitar. Mike Luzecki on bass. I don't know if I said him yet. But yeah. Kind of like this very fusion-y thing. But it was great. Big like visuals. It was like super trippy.
Nice.
There was a lot of really cool music that was happening. A lot of like noise shows, a lot of like grimy house art shows.
Yeah. And just to go back to sort of growing up and stuff, like what were the early influences in the house, music wise, you know, like, you know, what were you listening? What were you guys listening to? What were some of the big influences there?
So my dad doesn't really, he never really listened to that much music. I think sometimes he would play like Queen.
Okay, sure.
And stuff, but he wasn't really the musical one. My mom would always be playing like Tom Petty, Coldplay, you know, so I went with her to those first two concerts.
Yeah.
A lot of Sheryl Crow.
Okay.
A lot of, who else? Keith Urban, you know.
Fantastic.
A lot of Elton John.
Okay.
Tons of Elton John. Sure. And then she used to like write some songs and like play a little bit of piano when I was very little.
Okay.
And she was very supportive of me playing music. One of my uncles is a drummer and I remember thinking that was really cool. So I actually started out on drums.
Like
angry post-divorce drums for like 2 years, just like Nirvana songs with no technique.
Sure.
And then eventually mom was like, you should try guitar. Like,
yeah.
You know, and she showed me like some, I forget what it was, but it was like some John Denver song on her old Yamaha acoustic.
Okay.
And then she bet me that I couldn't learn Stairway to Heaven. And it was like summer. I like had nothing to do. I was just like hyper fixate. I worked on it straight for like 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And I was able to do everything except for like the high part of the solo. And then I just never put. I think I got like a ride cymbal, like some shitty used ride cymbal with the money, and then like just stopped playing drums completely. And
right.
And yeah, that, and I tried out for the jazz band on drums, I think right before then.
Okay, sure.
I didn't get in.
Yeah.
Because Jairus Yokely beat me.
Shout out Jairus Yokely.
Shout out Jairus. and he's stayed very good at drums. But he was killing back then too. But yeah, we were like in the jazz band and stuff together. So it was a heavy high school, well, for sure.
Okay. And it, so guitar was very much just introduce you like with that bet then, really.
Yeah, kinda.
Crazy. And so through that summer you sort of learned guitar and then got in the jazz program?
Yeah, the next year I auditioned for the jazz program, and then because I think it was like in seventh grade, I didn't make the seventh grade jazz band.
Okay, sure.
And then throughout that year was when I started playing guitar, and then the next year I made it into the jazz band. I think I hit up Corey for lessons right before eighth grade. He okay. helped me for the audition, and then I sure, studied sure. with him throughout eighth grade and almost like freshman year of high school.
Yeah. And then no sort of lessons like in later high school.
There's a guy named Matthew Von Doren who I think still lives in St. Louis. I took a couple lessons with him. He helped give me some like good supplemental stuff. But then after that, I was like just listening to like a bunch of, I kind of finessed my high school education where I think like my senior year, I was like, I practiced during lunch. It was like outdoor education class. I just skipped my math class. I just skipped.
Sure.
Like go to school. But like, I was just doing transcript, like Kurt Rosenwinkel transcriptions in the band room and like trying to learn tunes and Jeez. Listen to Schofield. And I remember I would be like student assisting for another one of the classes. I was like a student assistant for the band director. So I was just organizing charts and just like listening to this. It's just one like bootleg of Kurt Rosenwinkel playing with this quartet in Philly. It was at something jazz cafe or something.
Okay. No,
I can't remember the name of it, but that was like, I just remember just smelling all the musty charts and that record.
That sounds fantastic. So you were well equipped to go to university, and the audition process was good? Was it complicated?
I could sound like I knew what I was doing pretty well.
Sure.
You know, it's kind of a weird adolescent thing of music making for me at that age, where it's like I was good at like pretending like I knew what I was doing, and I knew how to do things that I knew other people would do when they knew what they were doing. So right. It sounded like I knew what I was doing, but I didn't really know why they worked.
Right. Sure.
So, and then I couldn't really read.
Yeah.
You know, I could get through it kind of, right. But not to the standard that like UNT is a very reading heavy school.
Right.
So I got in, and then I was just like, I really just tried to get my shit together that first summer after freshman year. Cause I was like last chair in the guitar ensemble, which is very fun, but it's like five guitar players doing arrangements for five guitars, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of a crazy like runoff band for all the extra guitarists. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, okay, that sucks. Like, I don't want to, I mean, it was very fun, but like, I'm like, I want to be in like one of the big bands. Cause at UNT, it's like the 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, all the way down to, I think, 9 o'clock. And okay. So, and everything except for the one o'clock and the 2 o'clock both have one guitar player in them. And then all the other ones have two.
Okay.
It's like a lot of, you know, 30, it's like 30 slots. And then after that summer, that first summer, I just created this crazy practice schedule where like I wake up in the morning, I would like practice sight reading while I drank coffee. And then I would go and just listen to that Kurt Rosenwinkel album Reflections for like an hour or two, just like listen to it twice straight through by the pool.
Sure.
And then I would just like practice standards for an hour. And then I'd take a break, and then I'd like try to write some stuff. It was basically like a whole 8-hour practice routine. And then I'd go to jam sessions at night. Yeah. And I just like, it was my full Dragon Ball Z moment, you know?
Sure.
And then like the next year back at the school, I think I made the 4 o'clock or the 3 o'clock.
Okay.
And I made the 2 o'clock the next semester. And then I was so tense from practicing so much that like my nerve started getting really agitated in my arm. And I had to take a full semester off, two semesters off from music classes. And then, yeah, it took like 8 months before I could play again.
Oh my gosh.
Crazy. Because it was like, it was a posture thing, but it would only happen when I was playing. So then when I go to the doctor, I'd be like, good posture, be like, oh, like it, like nothing's wrong, it doesn't hurt now, but like when I play it does, right. But I ended up taking a bunch of Alexander Technique classes,
which
like is like a, it's like it's an acting thing, but it has a lot to do with like how you perceive movement in your body and how you like hold tension in your body.
Yeah
Like noticing when you're like, if you're brushing your teeth, are you like pushing into the countertop and like, you know, is your head in a balanced place? And just very like body mindfulness
type stuff. Yeah, sounds great for all musicians, you know, but also for actors, but
it's
also
definitely great. It's great for musicians, but it specifically was made by this dude, Alexander, who made it for like Shakespearean acting.
Right. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot of parallels with everything. And then I like took 6 months of taking it easy and like just reworking my technique for those 6 months and like really redeveloping this relationship with the guitar. And then after that, then I made the 2 o'clock and then I made the 1 o'clock and it was like great. And then
yeah,
I had the last little bit of time at school, I was just hanging out and playing in the jazz vocal ensembles, playing guitar for them. Because I loved just listening to the thick vocal arrangements.
That sounds great. When did things change, I guess, professionally for you? Was it in school? Was it after school? I know you just, you know, knowing a little bit of background, you moved to New York after. But when did things change professionally for you?
There's like a couple moments where... You know, I think moving to New York was a really big one.
Yeah.
But the way I even came to that was like, I was kind of doing this classic Dallas musician grind where like you have your decent church gig every Sunday. Maybe you're doing it on Wednesdays too. I was just doing mine once a week. And then we play weddings every once in a while.
Yeah.
Didn't really even try to play funk guitar until I was like 22. So it was such like a jazz snob up until then. But I did... It was, yeah, classic, like taught a couple lessons during the week, started trying to make like Instagram videos, church gig, cover band gig type thing. Yeah. And then like my car blew up in my driveway one day.
Oh my gosh.
My 95 Ford Taurus that was hanging on for dear life.
Yeah.
Finally kicked the bucket and it was like the battery exploded and like it melted a bunch of the metal. It just totaled itself.
Jeez.
On turn on. And I had enough money to get another like really bad car or move to New York where I didn't need a car. And that was, moving to New York was the scariest thing I could think of doing. And I was just like, why not? So I luckily Matt Young, the drummer I was playing with all the time, he lived close by and we were on the same church gig. So I knew I could like make consistent money every week. And I was living with the people I was doing the wedding gigs with. So I was like, okay, I think I can make this work. And I just saved up a bunch of money for 3 months. And then my friends that I was living with drove me to New York, bless their hearts. And like moved to New York in the middle of a blizzard, rammed into a snowbank. We were stranded in my apartment for like a couple days until the snow melted, and then they were able to drive back. And then I was in New York. And the first kind of bigger career thing happened was like, when I moved to New York, I decided that I wasn't going to do a church gig. I would do anything else but a church gig. Just because I was, so no shade to church gigs, but I was just really burnt out on them at that point. And I, you know, luckily that was when I first started making Instagram videos pretty consistently.
Yeah.
And there were a couple that like started to get a little bit of traction. It was right when the Discover page started. So okay. There was a couple months there, right when I moved to New York, great timing. But I was like, if you looked up hashtag guitar, somehow I was the one that was always in like the first three videos.
Sure.
You know? Right. So because of that, I started teaching a lot on Skype.
Okay.
So that helped supplement the New York rent that was like 3x, 4x what I was paying in Texas.
Yeah.
And I did one cover band gig with this like national cover band agency, International Musicians League.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, which we all, you know, have probably done something with them at this point. But they just transferred me from their Dallas system to their New York system. So I actually fell into pretty consistent work with them. Yeah. Again, very lucky for most of these things. And then that was able to keep me afloat while I was in New York. And I was doing like, I started to do some like pop stuff. The first like gig that I had, I was playing with this artist, Michael Bloom, who now goes by Whatever Mike. And they're so amazing, great performer. But as I was playing with them, my friend who was playing with Indie Irie ended up not being able to play one of those gigs and got me on as a sub.
Right.
So that was my first time, like, I'm on in-ears, I'm on, you know. I'm like learning these arrangements last second. She gave a list of like 45 songs to learn. Yeah. And it's like, she's not a new artist, not like people know people know every single one of her songs. Right. So it was a lot of pressure. That was like the first time I had ever kind of dipped my feet into like the pop territory.
Yeah.
Even though like, you know, you could say that she's not the pop, but it's like something that's functioning like that business wise.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
So then after that, my friend got back on the gig, but I started to like become known as the dude that like people could call to learn a bunch of songs last second.
In New York specifically.
Yeah. Yeah. Like a lot of these artists where it's like they live in LA, they're flying to New York to do some little pitchy, you know, they're playing at Spotify's lunch. They're going to play their top three songs just for people while they're eating their sweet green.
Right.
But like, I would get the call like that morning. It's like, hey, like Sam Fisher is coming. Like, can you learn these songs and like meet at the manager's office to play through them and then play the Spotify thing? And I'd be like, sure, I'm down.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that seems exciting. And it was exciting. And then, so I started to do that. And then because of that, I was just like, dang, like LA is where all this stuff is coming from.
Yeah.
I'm basically surviving in New York by living off of this like LA runoff stuff. And it was like, I don't know, New York's kind of a tricky place to live sometimes. It's pretty ruthless.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah.
And
compared to the Midwest for sure.
Compared to the Midwest, compared to Texas, compared to LA for sure. Yeah. And I was in New York for about 2.5 years.
Okay.
And around then, it was the combination of like the Instagram stuff kind of taking off.
Yeah.
Enough. I wouldn't say it stayed on like a crazy trajectory, but it was like enough happening that like I knew people in LA, people were starting to know about me a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
I was working with like music directors and stuff that were based out of LA. A lot of my friends were in LA. And then I got a call from my friend that used to live in this house. And this was the house I used to crash in when I would like visit for NAMM and like,
sure.
And he was like, hey, like we have a room opening up. Like, you mentioned maybe wanting to move to LA, just wanted to put it out there. And I was like, I can't right now, but I can in 6 months.
Right.
So they got like a sublet. Again, very lucky that they were down to do that.
Yeah.
And just like the next couple LA trips I had, I would just bring like two guitars, leave both of them here.
Right.
And had a friend that was driving across the US and like, I was like, hey, I'll like, you know, help you with gas if you just like take my amp and like my acoustic guitar and like one suitcase.
Right.
And he was down. So then that's how I got all my other stuff out here. I just flew out here and then
Whoa. Yeah. Stuff. So no major expenses to move across the country.
Not as bad as they could be.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
definitely like, you know, getting here and being like, okay, now I have to fully furnish my stuff. It's not nothing, but it's definitely not like paying for a truck and doing that whole thing.
Fantastic. And when timeline wise, when did you move to LA?
I moved to LA in end of 2019.
Oh my gosh.
So
what a time to move.
For
the pandemic.
I got here, spent November, like kind of like rubbing elbows with people. I got here like halfway through November. So it's like, I got a good month of meeting people, spent like 2 weeks at home, and then came back. There was like kind of NAMM time.
Yeah.
Like got to see everyone's like, oh, this is great. Got like my first call with Sophia Carson, who was like in the movie The Descendants.
Okay, cool.
Just like ex-Disney. Or actually, I think she's still with Disney technically.
Okay.
But it was like we did like a radio tour for like 2 weeks. Came back, was about to go out with like a modern jazz thing with this band Maison. And then on the way to the airport, I got the call that it was right when COVID started happening. And I got the call that LA, the state of LA or the state of California, closed down all the venues over 250, and we were playing a 300 cap room. So it was like, we're like, okay, I guess I turned the Uber around and went back home.
Yeah. Jeez. Okay. Well, that's fantastic. And now you're there.
Pandemic went back to teaching a lot.
Yes. Online. Yeah. Sure.
Once that opened up a little bit, started playing a lot more instrumental music, and then got the call for the Blue gig 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Was playing a little bit with Dove Cameron before then.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And then we're kind of where we are now.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a great, like just an overview here, but to get back into sort of the questions, what would you
say? Was that too in depth?
No, that was fantastic. What would you see as your primary creative output? Because I know there's the teaching, but there's also so many things. We mentioned gigging, we mentioned the pop stuff. But you know, we mentioned quite briefly Felty. We mentioned your recent EP. What would you say is the thing that you spend the most time on?
I'm always doing a lot of the lo-fi stuff. Like, I try to keep the releases with Felty pretty stacked because that is like, it's very fun and very, like, very much a creative outlet. But it's also like, since it's not like an artist project necessarily, it's kind of just like an experiment that did well.
Yeah. And, sure.
You know, I like a lot of my expenses get covered from doing a lot of the lo-fi stuff. I have another one called Recalibration Machine. So I try to like keep both of those fully stacked with releases. So it's usually I'm trying to finish like 6 songs per week on average. Oh my gosh. Yeah. And it's like, I work with a lot of people that are like, this one artist, I Am Alex, who's a producer in Copenhagen.
Okay.
I'll work with him a lot and he'll like send me a big folder of like a minute and a half of drums. There's like a up part and like a down part. And then I kind of chop those up in like normal, like 8-bar sections. So it's easy for him to go back and do it within his session.
Yeah.
And I'll just build out the guitars, the some effects, but mostly like guitar, bass, keys.
Yeah.
And melody and like, kind of like, you know, some producery moments. And then I send it back to him. He does a few more and then mixes and masters it, and then we put it out. So we've probably done, honestly, probably 60 songs at this point. We've definitely done a lot. So that's like a big chunk of my time. But then like, I would say my heart isn't as much in that. And right now it's like I'm mixing, doing like final mix notes on this project called To Wash Upon the Shore, which is a really, I'm really excited about this. Because I was working with this producer, Dan Lomparitis, who'd worked with a bunch of my close friends. We've done a lot of stuff together too. But I wanted to try to do like a session for guitar as the main character, mm-hmm. but like approach it like kind of how people approach pop sessions, where it's like, let's make a song. And we did that. And I, so like the whole record, I'm playing every instrument, and it was, a lot of them are one take, or like the first take. And it's this kind of contemporary jazz cinematic, like through composed album, which ended up, it's, I'm so stoked on it. Cause it's super vibey, and I feel like it really accurately describes all the aspects of music that I appreciate the most.
Yeah, sure.
And it's kind of, it like listens like almost like a Greek tragedy. There's like a whole trying to punch God aspect to it. It has a lot of ambient things and really heavy kind of parts. Almost like a, like Godspeed You Black Emperor or something.
Yeah, sure.
This like post-rock, like just heavy, noisy, drone-y stuff. But it's very much like about the guitar, and has that as the main character. So I'm really stoked to that. But now I'm having to arrange it for slightly larger ensemble. Then we get some good videos for when we release it. But that'll come out like later this year, before the fall, but probably late summer. And then I've also finished writing a trio / quartet record that I'm going to try to record later this year to release in the spring.
There you go. So we're getting a lot of the juicy information here.
Yeah, trying to do it as much as I can.
Yeah, that's great. And are these all released under your name?
Yeah, this will all be under Horace Bray.
Fantastic. So it seems like you're doing a lot of the recording, but also a lot of the gigging as well. See on the Instagram stuff. I wanted to talk briefly about gigging in the city versus gigging on tour. I know we touched on a little bit at the beginning of the podcast here, but to you, what's different about it, and how do you feel as Horace when you're on the road versus when you're in the city?
Ooh, I mean, I think a lot of the stuff I'm doing in the city is way more about me getting hired on for my voice that I have, where it's a lot of stuff like where we're all bringing compositions and we're doing the show, or it's like a modern jazz adjacent. And it's like, it's much more about like the character that each person has.
Sure.
And usually gigging outside the city tends to be more pop.
Yeah.
Stuff, or stuff that is more music industry feeling.
Yeah.
And that it's like, you kind of have to relax into being like the well-oiled cog in the machine. It's like, you gotta, you know, like I'm not, Like I don't know. It's like not the end of the world if you get stuck in traffic on the way to a gig downtown to play like improvised music. But it's also you don't want to be late. But you also cannot miss lobby call when you're doing a fly date with an artist. It's like you have to be early for everything. And so it's like it's a little bit of a different flow. I'm about to fly out tomorrow to do this thing with this composer, Steve Hackman, in Indianapolis. And we're doing a bunch of, he like arranged these incredible arrangements of Beatles songs. And it's for like live band with symphony.
Yeah. I think is it possible that we spoke about this like a year and a half ago?
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a crazy thing. It's very difficult. It's very difficult music. So that'll be the rest of my night. But, it's been really interesting because it's like Braylon Lacy on bass, who like has played with fucking everyone, like Badu and that whole crew.
Yeah.
It's usually Tayron Lockett on drums.
Oh, okay.
It's like a heavy, it's a heavy band.
Yeah. Crazy.
But yeah. But that's like a lot of like you have your schedule and you better stick to it.
Yes. There's a lot more at stake when you're flying out you know, when you're not playing improvised music, I guess.
I mean, it's like if I'm sure if I were flying out, like if I was doing a thing with like Haley Neiswanger and her band Mason, like the same things would apply to that. Like you still have to be on it, but everything's a little bit more loose when it's an in-town gig.
Yes, exactly. How have you adapted to the LA scene?
I think I like it a lot.
Yeah, sure.
Like You know, it's interesting. When I first moved out here, like, you know, nowadays I don't drink anymore. But when I first moved out here, I was like, you know, trying to go out and like rub elbows with people and like kind of do that. And nowadays it's much more like I like my little, like go on like my little hikes and I drink tea at night. And, you know, I like waking up early and like practicing acoustic guitar stuff before the day kind of gets going and stuff like that. So I think LA life is really nice because if you want it to, you can have the same intensity, almost the same intensity that you get in New York City, where if you want to stay out until five every night, like you totally can. And there'll be tons of really interesting things to do. And there's a show happening every single night. But if you want to turn that off and like live almost like a pseudo suburban kind of life, sometimes you can do that too. Yeah. And you can go in between the two, which is my favorite aspect of it. Cause it's like, you know, you're living in the middle of the US and it's like, it's just slow all the time. I think that would be too slow for me.
Yes. Yeah. No, I can see myself in what you're saying right now, where it's like in LA, you can have a little bit of both, you know?
Yeah. I feel like Toronto is probably similar to that too, where there's a lot you can do.
Yes.
But there's also like, you can go an hour outside the city and like be very, very chill.
Oh yeah. And it's completely different.
Yeah.
I'm from Northern Ontario and that's all trails and snowmobiling.
Oh, wow.
All that stuff. So, totally. Toronto, you can do a lot of different things, but let's say New York, it takes you an hour to just get across Manhattan or something like that.
Yeah.
It's definitely different. How does the music industry and landscape compare from, let's say, New York and LA for you?
I mean, most of the industry is in LA.
Sure.
Like in terms of like modern industry, like all the rehearsals happen here.
Yep.
Most of the rehearsals happen here. There's definitely some, but like there aren't really even big rehearsal places in New York anymore.
That's true.
Yeah. I think SIR has like one like private thing that like certain people can book.
Yeah.
But it's like it's either that or you're doing like Smash Studios, which is, you know, love Smash, but it's not like a big soundstage.
Right. There aren't a lot of sound stages in New York.
No. There's so many in LA. So many people get their full productions done. You know, every time I'm doing like rehearsal, like when I was rehearsing with Blue or something, it'd be like Doja Cat was next door. And like, oh, Rihanna has the whole building across the street rented out. Like it was so much of that all the time. And a lot of like the last minute calls happen here, you know, like you never know, like someone,
true.
Like it was like a couple of weeks ago, I couldn't do it because my mom was visiting and I was like, I can't, but I guess the guitar player for Natasha Bedingfield had like a family emergency.
Oh my.
And it was like, I had 48 hours notice if I wanted to do the Natasha Bedingfield gig. And like those, you don't really get those calls as often in New York.
Yes. Yeah.
You can, I'm I think part of it might be, I don't want to confuse being in LA with me just being older and more connected with people.
Right. But I think it's a geolocation thing as well, because you wouldn't get that call if you were, you know, a 6-hour flight.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's like a lot of the songs get written here too.
Yes. Yeah.
Not all of them, but a lot.
Yeah. Is there an importance there for you, or that you see where it's like, there's an important role that you play in the creation of the music that translates to the live show?
In which aspect?
In regards to like, is musicians that are creating or writing on the record.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Does that impact their role in live music, or do they get asked first if they want to be, on tour or playing live or something like that?
I thought there would be more overlap, but it's actually the people that make the records aren't usually the ones that play live.
Yeah.
There's certain exceptions, like Mason Stoops did he produced the new Lizzie McAlpine album, and I'm pretty sure he's doing all of her touring as well.
Right. Sure.
But I know he loves doing both. Yeah. There's a lot of people that really like, they have their pub deal and it's like, they're public,
club
doesn't want them to be on the road, because they won't be able to recoup. So there's a lot of people that like live the producery studio life, and then there's people that kind of live in live music.
Yeah.
And the few of us that kind of do both, like myself and Mason.
Yeah, yes, yeah. In a city that has such a high level of creative output like LA, you know, both in music, but also in TV and film and fashion, yeah. There's so many things going on, sports. How are you able to find your way in all of it, in all the chaos?
I mean, it's funny because LA is kind of one of those towns where there's so much of everything going on all the time. Like if you want to, like, you can kind of do whatever you want to do. Like, you know, if you want to be, I don't know, a professional juggler that specializes in juggling, like, I don't know, like something specific, like I juggle cats, like you can find your niche. Like there's, yeah. Like you can do that. Like there's a reason why, like you find all these like random people that live in LA and it's like, oh wait, you make a living making like custom Mancala pieces. Like what, like it's, you can really kind of do anything if you really put your mind to it.
Right.
It will not always be easy by any stretch, but like the ceiling is very, very high.
Mm-hmm.
Do you
think it's important to find your niche because there's so many people doing it?
Yeah, but also like not having a niche can also be a niche because there's not many people that can do everything. So it's like, I think it's easy to get a little too stressed and like self-shamey about being so spread out. Cause like to me, I may think I do way too many things,
right.
But then talking to you, you could be like, oh, well, no, like it all like makes sense. Or like, you know, you could talk to like, you know, Chris Thiele, and Chris Thiele, he's like, I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's a really great mandolin player.
Chris Thiele?
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, he's doing like, oh, I mean, does it make sense? Because like I'm doing Bach and then I'm doing this bluegrass stuff and then this stuff that's really cinematic.
Yeah.
And it's like, to us, it seems so cohesive. It's like,
right.
Of course, yeah. It's like, it's you. That it would be weird if you weren't doing that stuff. So I think it's important to be genuine to yourself because you never get to choose what gets traction.
Yes.
So only make sure you're only doing stuff that you could do all the time.
Very interesting. Yes.
You know, and I do, you know, I obviously say that from a place of somewhat privilege, you know, because I've been very fortunate in a lot of ways to be able to do the things I really enjoy doing. But, you know, it's like the famous story about the dude that wrote Cherry Pie, where he hated that song. And then they wanted him to put it out. He finally put it out. It blows up. And then all of a sudden, like, that was the only type of song people wanted him to write.
Yes. Yeah.
You know.
I think it's interesting in saying that, like, you got to watch out what you put out, because if it does get successful, you might be known as that, especially now.
Yeah.
Or you'll be asked or expected to recreate or reproduce something even similar to that. I think we see a lot of artists as well nowadays where it's like, where is the line between wanting to do the same thing because that record really worked, and then artistically you got to do something else. I think about when I think about that, I think about Radiohead.
Exactly. That was the first one I was thinking of.
Yeah. But even like a more modern example of that is like Rosalia or something, where it's like every record has been completely different.
Yeah.
But you know, I think it's only after a few projects that fans start to get that, okay, it'll be different every time. And we just got to look for who the artist is and what their creative output, what their creative output that they're putting out. Just recently, and just as a rec for those listening as well, the recent conversation with Rick Rubin that she had, Rosalia and Rick Rubin had a great conversation.
Oh, that's
where
I'm
pulling this
yet.
Information from. But yeah, it's a great chat. And she talks specifically about that balance about, you know, trying to want to do something like Motomami or whatever, but not necessarily feel like artistically not wanting to go there. So anyway, check it out if you can. But Horace, I wanted to speak to the social media part of your career. I find it's fascinating. And you know, I know some of my guitar friends knew you before I knew you because of social media. specifically. Can you speak to that rise, quote unquote? And do you remember the video or post or moment that really just blew up, kind of thing?
I mean, the first one that blew up wasn't really even on Instagram. It was on Facebook. And it was this video where I was playing like this 3/4/5 polyrhythm.
Yeah.
And it like got really big on a bunch of these like prog forums on Facebook. That was the first time I was just like, oh, the internet's kind of cool. This is, sure. This is sick. And yeah, but like it, when I was first moved to New York, I was really trying to gamify it. Like I knew I wanted to, like, it was a good thing that like I'd had some stuff that had gone well, but that was much more like felt like happenstance.
Yeah.
And it was just like a lucky chance that it hit. I was like, I need to keep that going. So I made a list of like 7 or 8 videos that I would kind of alternate in between. I'm like, okay, I'm going to do 3 or 4 a week. I'm going to do like a lesson video. Then I'm going to do a pop cover. Then I'm going to do a loop video. I'm going to do something where I'm like doing educational thing. A jazz standard, and I would like kind of alternate through those,
yes,
and try to keep it going. And eventually it's like you burn out. That's just kind of what happens. It's so hard to keep that going. But yeah, no, that was I think it's, especially with the way TikTok is now and stuff, it is the best form of free marketing. Free. You know, it doesn't cost you money. It costs you
a lot of time,
maybe mentality, like, you know, mental health and time.
Yeah.
But it's the free, like, there's no other way that you can have a chance of getting 20 million people to see your thing. You know, there's a reason why, like, you know, I remember there was some artist that my friend was it wasn't even producing for him yet. He did his first song and it's like, he just produced it himself. And he had it blow up on TikTok and he got, it was like 25,000 resaves.
I see.
The song got millions and millions and millions of views. And it was a great song.
Sure. So
that's the key part. It's like he had the viral moment and could like follow up with it.
I think arguably it has to be. It always has to come with the song to get continuous plays and continuous views. I don't want to say it's harder to get the viral moment, but once you get that viral moment, you better be sure that the song you know,
which is so funny because it's kind of create a flipped thing where now it's like you get the viral moment, you finish the song that it was for, and then you learn how to perform a lot of the time, because some of these people have never played on a stage. Some have.
Yeah,
some have, but a lot of them haven't. And it used to be you get really good at performing, you write a bunch of songs. Oh, the song is really good, therefore it does well. Then it gets the viral moment. It's completely backwards now.
Yeah,
which now it's kind of beautiful that something was able to flip it that much.
Yeah, I think it's nuts. I think like the whole thing right now where it's like people are doing like, hey, check out this demo, and then they base their sort of release schedule off of how that TikTok performed or something. It's like I think it's smart artistically, you know, not how it was before, but it's so interesting to me that it's like, okay, we'll base whether or not we put out the song by what people think about it months beforehand.
Yeah, crazy. Like maybe not that crazy. Maybe I'm just getting old and I'm like, that's not how it used to be.
Well, no, for sure. I know, it's mind blowing that this is where we're at.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. But I mean, social media, I think, is super valuable. I mean, nowadays, I post like fun live clips that I think are cool.
Yes.
I'm trying to like record more stuff with like my trio and put that out. I think I'm going to have another video that's like done getting edited this week.
Nice.
I'm just trying to like, just I really want to be spending my time like teaching at colleges, doing like clinics, and playing music that I make with my friends that like I really care about. And that's kind of where I'm at with it now. So everything in social media is like trying to funnel to that as much as it can.
Yeah. Talking about teaching, how has education played a role in your playing, in regards to like, yes, you know, education, yes, being a student, but also I want to talk about mostly about how being an educator has sort of influenced your playing.
Well, it keeps you very humble. I got to say that, like, because it's like, if I'm like play through these open triad exercises and remember to breathe and stay relaxed and be nice to yourself. If I cannot do that, like they can't, they're not going to, I mean, they may still take me seriously, but like, I'm going to feel like a putz. Like I'm going to feel like I can't, like I'm just faking it. Yeah. So, like it definitely keeps me humble in that I am doing everything I can to keep that stuff polished up as well.
Yes. Yeah. Totally.
It's also like very interesting because it's easy to become disconnected from like your point of view when you first started. Yeah. And, like what was exciting, what was confusing. It's easy to like kind of take that stuff for granted. And it's nice to like see people be like, oh yeah, like they don't understand how to play through a 2-5-1, or like, oh yeah, the 5-chord is just always really confusing for them.
Right.
I'm like, oh yeah, it is.
Yes. Yeah. Sure.
Right.
Yeah. And you remind yourself, because if, for me, I haven't taught much, but in the certain circumstances where it's like you have to rethink how things are being done because it comes so naturally sometimes, like after so many years of doing it, you're like, okay, how do I actually explain this? And then you actually like rethink about how you did it and how. Yeah. They need to think about it, or how that sort of concept has evolved over time of you're playing, where it's like, okay, this is how you should be playing it right now, but then later you
exactly could be playing it like this. Yeah, it's really interesting to like, you know, as I've taught more and more, it's I tend to be less like prescriptive of like, you need to be able to do this way.
Yes, sure.
And more like take this concept and explore with it and report back like what you find.
Yeah.
Which takes a more specific type of student too. But I feel like the students that go the farthest are the ones that are the most receptive to that type of teaching.
Mm. Yeah, no, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
This is a very general question.
Sure.
And I'm not expecting a very specific answer, but what do you think is the most important thing to learn in music?
Oh, I would say the most important thing to learn in music, if you are someone that is actively trying to make music a big part of your life, is to be kind to yourself regarding the process in which you make music. Because we've all been at a show and someone's taking a solo and they mess up and you can see them hate themselves for it.
Right.
We've all seen that before. Or the person that's way too nervous and is like, so worried that it's going to sound bad that then it sounds bad. I think being kind to yourself and patient with yourself throughout the process of making is a really important catalyst for making things that are the most genuinely you. Because if you're afraid to be you, it will never sound completely like you.
Fantastic. How important is continuous curiosity? Music.
I would say it's so important.
Yeah.
I mean, maintaining like the kind of childlike sense of play and curiosity is an important aspect of making music. It's a really important aspect of relationships. Like becoming really like complacent with how you do things in any way of your life is almost always like a negative. In a certain sense.
Yeah.
It's like even if like you brush your teeth the same way every single time and you're never thinking about it. And then you go to the dentist and they're like, oh, do you realize that you're like aren't brushing there? And then you're like, oh, like, you know, even in stuff like that, that's the same thing happens with music and the same thing happens with relationships, the same thing happens with, you know, any aspect of your life. So I think maintaining that is really important. Mm-hmm. But a funny way to maintain that is that you have to always be willing to take a risk.
Yes.
Because if you aren't willing to take risks, then that's what keeps you in the safe zone where you stop pushing yourself.
Yeah. How are you taking risks lately? And continuing to learn to learn like music?
I mean, by kind of trust falling into not really taking as many pop gigs this year.
Yeah.
You know, I'm being much more specific with like what I say yes to and hoping I can make ends meet and like still like feel like I'm being a responsible adult planning for retirement and everything.
Sure.
Whatever that means.
Yeah.
I think that's a big thing right now. And really letting myself think of myself as like an artist in a weird way of like I am like embracing the fact that like I love being a guitar player and I want to be known as a guitar player. And right. For a lot of people, I am known as a guitar player, but like I feel like my relationship with fully accepting that has had some like funny loop-de-loops to it over sure. The last decade. And it's been really nice to kind of relax into that type of acceptance and be like, you know what, if I want to play in Japan with my trio, I have to have a lot of fun, let myself have a lot of fun making trio music right now and like see where that goes. So that's like low key. That's like a soft goal.
Like sure.
Play a headline show in Japan with my trio.
And I guess the identity, I don't want to say crisis, but balance for you, like, is it like guitar player, like Horace as a guitar player versus like Horace as like the artist, like the artist facing?
Well, I would call it a crisis at points.
Sure.
It was definitely very much a crisis at points. But like when I was living in New York, I was making a lot of singer-songwriter music as well.
Right.
Which now like a lot of that is moved over to H Bray, except for on Apple Music because they don't let you move it, whatever. Right. I feel like no one really listens to Apple Music anyway, even though they pay more. But it was very much a crisis because I felt like all these things I loved about, like, I love writing music. I love singer-songwriters. I love, you know, I grew up listening to my mom do her music all the time, like just in the house.
Yeah.
And it has such like a resonant spot for me, but it wasn't like, it didn't make sense to like, to do like a launch video with Guitar Center, which I also had a lot of fun doing, if I was trying to be like the classic artist.
Sure,
like,
sure.
Like the Sufjan Stevens route or something where it's like it there was a lot of aspects of my life that weren't as compatible with that lifestyle.
Yeah.
And I was also the meanest to myself when I was singing because I've luckily been able to play with so many amazing singers that gave me a whole lot of people to compare myself to.
Sure.
I'll still sing, I'll still write, but I don't really want to put out that type of music now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it was that's much more like I'm kind of coming to like the conclusion of like trying to think of myself as an artist in terms of, let me get on the screen, in terms of singer-songwriter to like being like, I am a guitarist. That is really what I love.
Right.
And me, like kind of the third phase of that is like, oh, I am an artist, but a guitar player. And it's like, I'm not necessarily trying to be a singer-songwriter, but I am what I am.
Yeah.
And I'm going to put out whatever music as much as I can.
Exactly. With
whatever that means.
I think the environment has allowed for the multidisciplinary artists to thrive as well. You know,
definitely.
I think the expectations and the barriers have definitely gone down in that case in regards to, okay, you can be this, but you can also be that on a different day.
Especially in the marketing aspect of it.
Sure. Yeah.
Like yeah. Marketing and branding. It's like, you can make a lot, why am I blank? If Jacob Collier can do what he's doing,
yeah,
to that level of success, we don't need to stress about anything being too weird or too heady or like,
yeah.
You know, oh, but what if I like prog metal and jazz or like, you know, you just gotta do it. Like that's proof of concept right there.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of people like the dude that was in Stranger Things, Joe.
Yeah.
What's his, like that song is so killing and
yeah.
He's fully like smashing his artist career. And it's such a great actor. And it's like, I don't think people are worried about you being in a boxer niche like that anymore, but it's way more about like, what are you doing genuinely? Like, what do you really want to do? So,
yeah. You know. And I think specifically with social media and maybe how our world is evolving as well. There's so much, it's like centered now on individuality as well. And like the social media has really focused on this individual is doing something and not like a group of people, whether it was like that before, or I think it was like that before, where it's like, now we're following individual people. Like I'm following Horace Bray and I'm following Questlove, or I'm following John Mayer, and John Mayer can do whatever he wants because we're still following that account. So he can be into watches and he can be a PRS artist, or he could be whatever he's doing.
Yeah.
I think the world is allowing individuals to do whatever they want now. And I think it's great. Just want to wrap up with a few quick ones. What are you looking forward to at the moment?
Definitely the records I've been working on.
Yeah.
Really excited about those. I don't know. There's like some exciting stuff that like, I can't talk about it yet, but it's like, I don't know. There's some fun shows that like, it would be really great if they happen. I think it would be really fun. Who knows if everything, you know, everything's always kind of like, you know, fluttering around until it gets solidified. Mostly just really excited for these records, excited to continue like, you know, developing my stuff and like living in LA and like learning how to be an adult and moving through life and seeing my family and I don't know, all that stuff.
Right. And other than playing in Japan with your trio, what's the dream?
The dream? Yeah. Oh. Yeah, I would love, in addition to that, like I would love to like do like the jazz festival circuit with like my group. Do something that's like arranged with strings. Like I've talked to Steve about it, Steve Hackman, a little bit, but it would be so great to have a project that like gets arranged for, it gets arranged for like symphony orchestra.
Yeah. Oh man.
I think that would be so fun and so interesting.
I love strings. Shout out to strings.
shout out to strings. They've gotten us so far.
Wanted to conclude with something that we call here at the Cloud Machine at Eights, which is the producer's game. Which is basically an opportunity for our listeners to know a little bit more about you, but also your preferences and maybe some things that you like. And basically the producer's game is giving you a chance to executive produce your dream album.
Wow.
Yeah, so basically I would ask you to executive produce this record and choose who would be the artist, who would be putting it out, the producers, who would be in the band, the studio, and the city, as in the studio, you could bring like Abbey Road to New York is the example I always give. And then the era, when this album would be released. And for you, I put composers, as in who would be composers on the record. So we can go through it quite smoothly as well, take our time here.
Yeah.
What comes to mind first?
I mean, in terms of location?
Yeah, sure.
I don't know if there's like a studio I really, really love like that, but I would love something with the accessibility of like Los Angeles.
Sure.
Because the amount of people that can get around here.
Yeah.
I would love it to be like in a little bit more of like nature, like Pacific Northwest or something.
Sure. Bringing LA to the Pacific.
Put LA in a forest.
There you go.
Step one.
Yeah. What about the era? Or maybe let's start at the top. Artists, who would be the artists? It could be like a various artist type thing, you know, if you could have like multiple artists on the project.
I mean, honestly, it would probably, the first person that comes to mind is I would love to create a record with Emily King.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Okay.
Like it's gotten me through every single major breakup I've ever had. Like, and you know, that really ties into producers. Like, I'm such a fan of Jeremy Most.
Okay.
Who's done almost, I think, maybe everything that she's done.
Yeah.
But that would be a really great dream team to work with.
Fantastic. The band, who would be in the band?
Me.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, Jeremy is an insane guitarist.
Yeah.
Band.
And this is not to complicate things, dead or alive?
Dead or alive? Yeah. It's breaking physics. I mean, I think it'd be sick if it was like me, Jeremy, and like Blake Mills.
Oh.
On guitar.
Sure.
I think that would actually be a really interesting pairing of people.
Yeah.
In terms of bassists. Probably like, maybe like Edgar Meyer.
Okay.
On bass, he's like an upright classical bluegrass dude.
Great.
Or like Pino.
Sure. Yeah.
Maybe like both.
Yeah. Yes.
Actually, both could be sick.
Yeah.
Like, I probably like want some of my like really good friends from New York, like on vocals.
Yeah.
Michael and Melissa McMillan and Randa Joan and Camille Trust and like these people and Alita Moses, who's actually out with Jacob Collier. Those are like, that was like the crew of like female singers that like I played with all the time.
Sure, sure.
And then
drums?
Drums is hard.
Yeah.
Maybe like there's this dude Jay Bellarose in LA.
Oh yeah.
He's so crazy good.
Yeah.
Either Jay or actually even my friend Matt Young in Texas, in Dallas. He's like so appropriate on everything. some combination of them. Yeah.
I love that. Keys? Just adding some things in here.
Keys. Let's go Brad Mehldau.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Yeah. Game over.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fantastic. Okay. Well, that's how we basically conclude the podcast.
Great.
Yeah. Thank you for being on. And it was so insightful to learn a little bit more about you. We hadn't necessarily spoke that much.
No.
Your connections here in Toronto and shout out Marina as well, who's upstairs right now for that connection and also TJ Wylow.
Yeah. Big shout out TJ.
Yeah. Which he's now in LA.
I'm sure. I've heard. I think he is living. I never see him, but I think we live like a mile from each other.
Okay. Well, there you go.
Yeah.
It was so insightful to learn a little bit more about your journey and thank you for coming on.
Oh man, of course. Thank you so much for asking me.
Yeah. For the people listening, make sure to check out his socials at Horace Bray for all things Horace and also Felty Music for all things lo-fi. I also want to thank those who are listening to the Cloud Machine Podcast. This is the 63rd episode, and we'd like to keep this platform as interactive as it can be. So please leave your comments, your questions, your reviews down below as well if you're listening on Apple Podcasts or whatever. And don't hesitate to subscribe to get the notifications. As always, people, stay safe, and we'll see you next week. Thanks again, everybody. Bye.